the Engage Midwife podcast. This is Missy.
And this is Kara.
Gosh, it feels like it's been a really long time since we've talked.
I know. It does. It does. A lot's happened. A lot's going on. It's a busy time.
We went to the meeting. We met lots of people.
Yeah. Working hard. You're catching lots of babies, and I'm teaching lots of students, and things are good.
We had relaxed at the beach.
Yeah, that went really well. I'm jealous that I couldn't be there.
Next time, friend, next time.
That's right. Put it on your calendars, everyone. This time, next year, you and us at the beach.
Maybe even fall.
Yeah.
So, what are we talking about today?
I think it would be awesome if we talked about labor and progress and Pitocin. What do you think?
No, I think it's great. I also am like thinking about how we all grew up, the midwives and the nurses of our generation, when we, you know, when we started in labor and delivery in like the late 90s and early 2000s, and how much has changed since we were babies.
Yeah, it's been a few days. I just realized recently, because it's graduation time, that I've been a nurse for 25 years, which is crazy. That's like a whole grown human. Like
a grown adult.
It is. So pretty cool to think about. And I was fortunate. I started right into labor and delivery and mother, baby, and postpartum and the newborn nursery, all those different areas. And a lot has changed. A lot has changed even in the last 15 years. And so I think it's good to update about labor progress and our use of Pitocin, because that has definitely changed a lot over the years.
Yeah. And I think I've had a lot of conversations recently about sort of empiric things that we did. And people were like, well, there's no evidence for that. And actually, in reality, there's a ton of evidence for some of the things that we used to just do because we knew it worked. So I think those will be an interesting, you know, branch of this conversation as well.
I think it's also interesting that so much of what seems to be newer recommendations in a lot of different areas in labor and birth really match the midwifery model and are a lot of things that midwives have been doing for years.
I know. I also think that like, we need to do an episode just on like the things in labor and delivery that midwives do that there isn't evidence to support. And maybe some of our listeners will be motivated to like do some of that maybe research that says like, hey, this thing does work. Or like a really great example is trying to get people to pee postpartum, right? And yeah. We know that if you put a couple of drops of peppermint oil in a hat, that it just works. But why? And is there good evidence to support that it really does work? So it's that kind of stuff. But I think one of the things we're going to talk about with Pitocin actually goes along those lines as well.
Yep. Yep. All right. So where should we start?
Well, let's take people back 20 years to when we started doing this and the kinds of questions that were on our board exam about labor progress. So the old school thinking about labor progress, which all the older midwives or seasoned midwives that are listening will remember that we just did everything on Friedman's curve.
Yeah, everything was about, were they on the curve? Had they fallen off the curve? Were we trying to get them back on the curve?
Right. Absolutely. And Friedman, I'm going to give you, I'm looking really quick because I want to be right about the accuracy of this, but Friedman's curve is really, really old. It first was published in 1954. So it was about due for an update on, is this actually the most accurate way we can classify labor? So for those of people who don't know about Friedman, I'll just give you a brief like overview. So Friedman was the very first person. This is kind of the gold standard landmark research about labor progress. And it very much defined a labor curve that said, hey, if you do not have 1.2 centimeters of dilation in a prime and 1.5 centimeters per hour dilation in a multip, then you had abnormal labor progress. And their definition on Friedman is no appreciable change of cervical dilation in the presence of adequate contractions for 2 hours was the definition of arrest. And I'm sure lots of people are like shaking their head. You mean like, what do you mean they had to dilate a centimeter and a half every hour if they were a multip? That meant you expected that they went from 7 to 10 in under 2 hours.
Right. It's definitely where our centimeter an hour kind of idea came from.
Yes. So the thing about this is, you know, how we manage labor, what we know about women's bodies, how we look at anatomy and physiology and hormones of labor. We just know now that like this doesn't fit every obstetrical population.
Right.
Right. So many things. And this is another whole conversation. There are so many factors that play into how we use oxytocin and how we, the number of people that we induce and maternal age and maternal body habitus. There's all kinds of things that alter how bodies progress through labor. And so the article that I think we should, that we're going to focus on really when we talk about labor progress is the Zhang article. Mm-hmm. And the Zhang article was published in 2010. Not new, not new. 2010, it's 12 years, 13 years old now. And it basically talks about like, hey, is there a better way for us to talk about more flexible parameters for labor?
You're right. It's not new, but just as you were saying those time differences, it was 55 years after Friedman. And so we all operated on Friedman's system for so long. It does still feel new to some people because it was only 12 or 13 years ago. So,
right. So the Zhang article, I just want to be clear because I feel strongly about sample size and that usually helps me very much classify like how much faith do I put in any particular study? And in this particular article, they looked at like 62,000 pregnant patients who had singleton pregnancies. And the other sort of inclusion criteria here were not just singleton pregnancy, but spontaneous onset of labor, vertex presentation, who progressed to vaginal delivery. So, but still, this is very midwifery oriented, right? 62,000 women with normal, non-complicated, spontaneous vaginal deliveries and what their time from labor onset to delivery was.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So what did we learn, right? We really learned that late in latent phase, so between 4 and 6 centimeters, that there very much can be a long sort of what I would call a lull in latent phase where based on their research that it can take women up to 6 hours to go from 4 to 5 centimeters and up to 3 hours to go from 5 to 6 centimeters. So basically what they're saying is it's totally normal for women to take 9 hours to go from 4 to 6.
Which is so crazy because when you tie that back to what we were saying at the beginning, we used to say active labor was at 4 centimeters. I mean, I operated under that for the first 15 years of my career. Crazy.
That's absolutely true. The other piece of this is that we know once they get to 6 centimeters, that multips are going to progress faster. That's just it's very much a given. It's something that we've always sort of known in the literature. But the numbers look like this, that nullips with and without an epidural usually progress from 6 centimeters to complete in 3.6 and 2.8 hours respectively. So 3.6 with an epidural, 2.8 after. So think about this when we have patients who are sitting at 4 centimeters who aren't in active labor, right?
Mm-hmm.
It might take them 9 hours to get to 6 centimeters, but after 6 centimeters, 3 or 4 hours is reasonable.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
What would our old school docs think of that?
Yeah. Just when we, and I think one of the interesting things is just that relabeling of the phases of first stage labor. So you've mentioned a couple, you mentioned latent and then active. I mean, latent we used to say was, you know, 0 to 3. And then once you were 4, you were in active labor. And that changes things when we consider latent is 0 to 5. And then once you reach 6, then you're in active labor. That really changes timelines and has a profound impact in that patience, which is, I think, one of most midwives' best attributes, patience is a virtue and can really be helpful in helping patients achieve a vaginal birth.
Absolutely. I also remember when I was a brand new baby midwife in 2006, in 2005 and 2006, people being like, well, she's not changing.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, yeah. And it was very discouraging to be like, why can't we just give her time? Why can't we do the, like, try some things, try some spinning, try some whatever. And I know for a fact early in my career, people got cut simply for not being on a good labor curve.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So the one thing I was going to mention too, when we were talking about like how different the population is now versus when Friedman's curve came out, one of the things that's also in the literature, which I was saying could be another whole podcast episode, is how obese women respond to induction agents. And there's a whole body of literature on that. And what we should be doing to help women who have a high BMI achieve vaginal delivery and not end up in like an arrest situation. So again, there's literature to support what we should be doing differently.
Yeah, I think you mentioned Zhang, and that was certainly like life-changing for most of us in the OB field and midwifery. But I think it's also important that we mention a midwife researcher that's helped a lot on labor progress. And that's Jeremy Neal and his research team. And he was originally, I think, out of Ohio and now is at Vanderbilt. And there's just some really incredible midwives doing really incredible research. And so if you haven't taken a look at his work, you should definitely do so.
Yeah. Shout out to Jeremy because he was at Ohio State with me when I was an accelerated nursing student and he was been doing midwifery and finishing his PhD. And now I think he probably thinks I'm following him because he came to Vanderbilt and now I'm here as well. So funny, like we've known each other for a really long time.
He's a good person to follow.
Yeah. And he does talk a lot about labor progress in his research. So he like also in another aside, Joyce Roberts was also at Ohio State when Dr. Neal was there. And Joyce did all the good research on second stage, right? She was the one who headed up a lot of that second stage physiologic pushing research. So it all sort of goes together, right?
That's awesome. Yeah. I love when midwives are making such huge contributions to our practice.
So, all right. So 6 is the new 4, right? That's the thing. 6 is the new 4. Actively. And what happens when they get to 6? So, you know, Friedman said 2 hours of no change and you are off the curve. It's very interesting now in clinical practice how much time we give people. And I always say, like, if we've given them, I mean, sometimes 8, 10, 12 hours of no change, like, that's a lot. I would love to see the cost analysis on how long we wait in some of these cases for people to make cervical change, especially in places where you're space limited or resource limited. Yeah. But we do have so much more flexibility in our definition of labor progress that I do think, and the research shows that we have been able to decrease some of the cesarean rate just based on labor progress.
Yeah, I think labor progress, but then we also have so many more options for ripening. We have different options for augmentation and induction. We have, I always laugh and say, you know, our academic health center is probably one of the most patient places that we have. And it's because the staff is there all the time and we're not trying to rush things based on, you know, call schedules and different things. But but also while they're patient, they're pretty intervention heavy. But we do have lots of different options, which is nice.
Really nice. And allows us to decrease some of our cesarean rate.
Maybe. Exactly. Exactly.
So
should we talk a little about our main augmentation method?
Yeah, or medication? Let's do that, because then I want to get into some of the things that go along with that. So what are we talking about?
We're talking about oxytocin, or synthetic oxytocin called Pitocin. And that is the hormone of labor induction.
Fantastic. I mentioned something to me earlier about oxytocin. What was the interesting fun fact that you shared?
Oh, that Pitocin or oxytocin has a black box warning from the FDA, which I think is so funny, because the black box warning says that oxytocin is not indicated for elective induction of labor, which is so funny to me. But it goes on to say that elective induction of labor is when we induce with no medical indications, and that there is not an available amount of data that can help us evaluate the benefit to risk consideration. So to me, take that with a grain of salt. Understand that you should be doing appropriate informed consent with patients, and that as the educated, competent provider, you are doing the risk benefits calculation and deciding whether or not you think oxytocin is appropriate for elective induction.
I also think that, like, when most people think about Pitocin outside of the US, they're thinking about that it's a life-saving drug to prevent postpartum hemorrhage.
Yes, true. Not
something that we're using for elective induction. That seems very Western medicine.
Yeah. So how does oxytocin or Pitocin work? And I think it's important. I might say a lot of words and people are like, la, la, la. But it is helpful to understand how it works. So oxytocin stimulates the uterine contractions by activating receptors in the uterus that trigger increases in intracellular calcium levels in the actual uterine myofibrils, those muscle fibers. Oxytocin also increases local prostaglandin production, which then further stimulates uterine contractions. When we give it IV, the onset of action is almost immediate, and the duration of action is up to 1 hour. And the half-life is 1 to 6 minutes. And that can be a little bit more delayed late in pregnancy. So sometimes the half-life will be just a little bit more extended later in pregnancy.
Also, when we think about like Pitocin, and I'm going to get to this when we talk more about like maybe some adjunct things with induction, the mechanism of action is so important, because you said calcium.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So side note, Kara, remind me when we start talking about things to like give that little calcium spiel.
Yeah, absolutely. So just I'm going to briefly mention dosing, just because we're talking here about medication and how it's used, but that's going to have some effect later in our conversation as well. But when we typically use Pitocin, and most people are doing a low dose regimen, usually they're starting at 0.5 to 2 milliunits per minute, and then increasing it by 1 to 2 milliunits every 15 to 40 minutes. And that was an ACOG recommendation back from 2009 of a low dose protocol. Many people have moved more to like an every 30 minute kind of increase, because the knowing that the half-life and how long it takes for the medication to take effect, that sort of thing, that if we give a little bit more time for those receptors and don't do it every 15 minutes, then the outcomes aren't really that different and it may lead to less tachycystole. The high dose regimen is starting at 6 milliunits per minute and then increasing by 3 to 6 every 15 to 40 minutes. And that again was an ACOG high dose recommendation from 2009. I don't see as many places using the high dose regimen, but certainly some places still do. So that's a little bit of background on our oxytocin or Pitocin use.
I think at Vanderbilt, we started doing more 6x6, mostly because for appropriate people, you know, getting them into active phase, it decreases bed space time. You know, like when you have a limited amount of beds, there are people that are candidates for that high dose regimen to sort of jumpstart their labor.
Sure. And, you know, the most important part of this, I think, is that we're assessing how the fetus is responding to the contractions, how the patient is, responding to the contractions, not only pain and that sort of thing, but vital signs, how they're responding and tolerating their environment. How's that?
No, I love that. It's such like a good, paints a good picture, like of what we're hoping for in terms of getting through an induction process or an augmentation process. So, all right. So I want to talk about an empiric thing that comes along with augmentation and induction.
Okay.
So for a lot of years, and I was taught this by an old nurse, and this was probably way before there was any literature to support it, is what does happen if we have a protracted latent phase or a protracted active phase of labor? And the old school part is, well, did you try a pit break or a washout? Right. And those are different. They're different, but the same. So, and interesting, in the last like 7 to 10 years, there's been some really good research that's come out about what happens if we turn pit off and the timing of what turning the pit off looks like. And then do we turn the pit back on?
Right. So,
you know, a pit break can be defined in 1,000 different ways, depending on your facility. But remember that the uterus is a muscle, right? And it has receptors for Pitocin/oxytocin on it. And when we give that medication, it floods those uterine receptors with that medication, causing that myometrial contraction, right?
Right.
And so what do we need to think about with a muscle that is contracting is, how do we get those receptors to let go so that the Pitocin I'm giving may be more effective? That's one. And how do we make the uterus do what we want it to in an effective way?
So, yeah, it's interesting to think about. Certainly pit breaks are kind of an old school way of thinking of like, let's try this when things have kind of stalled. But I think it's becoming a little bit more, let's find the evidence to support this. And what does giving a pit break actually do?
Right. Absolutely. It's also a conversation that I have with patients about just, again, about anatomy and physiology. It's the same conversation that I have when we give IV pain medication, right? You're flooding the receptors. You have to wait for the receptors to be open to receiving more medication.
Right, right.
So there are several really great articles about pit breaks or just discontinuation of Pitocin altogether in active phase. So I'm not sure, where should we start?
Let's think about pit breaks. Like, I think, you know, initially when you and I were having a conversation, and so many of our podcast episodes come out of us talking about what we're doing in practice. And you had mentioned to me that you came across this really cool article that was like, pit breaks are awesome and they don't really increase our C-section rates. And it was more just about the use of pit breaks, not so much the length of time.
Right. As that, because there's a varying sort of body of research. And I think just like with anything, the flexible parameters of how we would do a pit break kind of matter. And it matters for bed space and it matters for nursing. It matters for all the things. So let's talk first about what happens in protracted latent phase. We have already said that Zhang's article tells us that latent phase, especially from 4 to 6 centimeters, can take a long time.
Mm-hmm.
There is original research published in 2020 that talks about oxytocin rest. And this is just in nullips, right? In latent phase. And it was 267 patients, not a huge sample size, but they rested their patients with PIT during this like protracted latent phase of labor. And their research showed that if they gave their patients at least 8 hours of Pitocin rest, that it does decrease the risk of cesarean delivery for protracted latent phase of labor without increasing maternal or neonatal morbidity or mortality. Great. Now, here's what happens the first time I share this information, that in latent phase, we should turn their PIT off for 8 hours. We don't have time for that, turning off the PIT for 8 hours. I don't disagree that we don't have a lot of time for that, especially in the place that I work, but in a lot of places, you don't have time for 8 hours of latent phase rest. This goes back to my whole argument about elective inductions and inductions in general and understanding Bishop's score, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If we wouldn't need oxytocin rest in latent phase, if we were inducing people who had, or augmenting people who had favorable cervix. Right. So
right.
What does that mean? It means a Bishop score 8 or over means their cervix is ready to have a baby. That's just simply it. So again, another conversation for another day is, are we really preparing people for induction of labor, understanding what ripening looks like, and then understanding what actual labor induction looks like? Two steps, right? A ripening step and an induction step.
It also made me think a little bit, Missy, as you were talking here, the idea of, you know, when it's spontaneous labor, waiting for admission until active labor versus when we're doing induction of labor, whether it's elective or medically indicated, making sure exactly what you said, that we're ripening the cervix appropriately before we start the induction process.
Right. The ripening part makes so much sense. And I have so many thoughts about outpatient ripening, but again, mm-hmm. another topic for another day is, you know, what does the literature say about outpatient ripening, and should we be doing that? And does that decrease our time in bed? And does that decrease our cesarean rate if we've got people who are doing outpatient ripening? I think it's certainly something to look at.
Yeah. Great idea.
So, all right. So basically, the 2020 research, this is McAdoo's article, original research from 2020. A PIT break of 8 hours in latent phase will decrease cesarean rate. I love that. Anything that says in the results that it decreases cesarean rate is something that I'm going to pay attention to.
Yeah. And I think the interesting thing is that it in their study, it not only reduced the risk of cesarean delivery, but it did not increase any maternal or neonatal morbidity. So that's awesome.
Yeah. Yep. So we know in latent phase what to do and like turn it off, right? Turn it off and be done with it for 8 hours. Zhang will tell you 9 hours from 4 to 6. 9 hours. And that's a normal non-augmented labor, but it's a long time from 4 to 6. So we have to be cognizant of that in our management plans.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'd like to now talk a little bit about what happens when somebody gets to 6 centimeters. And the article is Saccone, and it's discontinuation of oxytocin infusion in active phase of labor. And this is a very good systematic review / meta-analysis that was published in the Green Journal in 2017. So again, not new literature. In 1,500 singleton gestation pregnancies, where when patients are undergoing elective induction, they waited for the patient to get to active phase. They defined it as 5, but as we've been talking, you know, we define it as 6. But if you get them to active labor and discontinue their Pitocin completely, that they did see a reduction in cesarean delivery and a reduction in uterine tachycystole. Also knowing that like this is a great option for women who are, for lack of a better word, stuck.
Yeah, I think so. And then also just as you were saying that, it made me think about those patients that really don't want an induction and the idea that maybe once we get them to active labor, we could turn the PIT off, right?
Yep. Yep. And, you know, sometimes we do see patients who come in, they wanted a more natural delivery. They wanted a home birth. They wanted a birth center birth. And if for whatever reason, it didn't work out. And so this is a great thing to offer them. Like we can use Pitocin until we get you into active phase and then turn it off and see what happens.
Yeah. So do they talk in their article, Missy, about the length of time of how long the Pitocin's, I know you mentioned that we could turn it off completely, but do they mention timeframes at all?
No, this meta-analysis is very clear that at active labor, you literally just turn it off. There's no real conversation about increase, like turning it back on, et cetera, right?
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, so this literally is a turn it off and be done. Now, it does, like I said, the results said that they decreased their C-section rate. And when we talk about bedtime, unlike what we were talking about with the article about latent phase, which is 8 hours of bedtime, turning off Pitocin in active phase was only shown to increase time to delivery by 27 minutes.
Well, that's like nothing.
I mean, by the time you check your patients and write your notes, your 27 minutes is over. So
that's amazing.
Right. So I would encourage people to go to this article and, you know, peruse it. Just because I think like these are two great options, right? Things that we can do to facilitate progress on the part of our patients.
Yeah. I know that in that 2020 article that you mentioned first, that they did look at different timeframes, but the having it off for at least 8 hours was really their recommendation and conclusion that they came to. But I think it is awesome that they looked at, you know, less than 2 hour break, a 2 to 4 hour break, you know, those kinds of ideas, because I do think that's where we get into lots of variation. And some of that comes from just a lot of different providers trying a lot of different things. And when I think of a PIT break, you know, so many people around my area will talk about a 30 minute PIT break. And I'm like, I'd really rather have an hour or two. So it's just interesting to think about what people are doing in practice.
Right. I have so many thoughts about this particular topic because we vary so greatly in what we do in clinical practice, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to mention a few things that I think can be topics, but they're also things to look into. So I like to talk about adjunct therapies that go along with what happens when we stop somebody's Pitocin. And some of this is when we stop their Pitocin with the intention of restarting it.
Right, right. Okay?
So, Kara, remind me again what you said about physiology of uterine muscle. Like, what's the electrolyte that we are thinking about?
So, optimal levels of calcium are important for contractions and the strength of the contractions in uterine muscle. So, if you have too little calcium, you have reduced contractions. Not only the frequency of them, but the strength of them.
All right. So I want to talk about two different things that have to do with some calcium kinds of issues and some drug therapies. Okay. So interestingly enough, when I turn PIT off, I always tell my nurses to give the patient 1,000 of Tums. And they're like, why? And I'm like, I don't know. It just works. And then a few years ago, I went and looked at the mechanism of action of Pitocin and started thinking more about anatomy of the uterine muscle. And I was like, it's calcium dependent, right? Yeah. So giving a patient Tums is not empiric. It's actually working with the physiology of the uterine muscle to sort of reset with the calcium that you're giving them.
Yep.
So just a thing to keep in your back pocket, 1,000 of Tums has never really hurt anyone if you're thinking about how to make the uterine muscle work more efficiently.
Yes, I'm with you. I started doing this several years ago and didn't really know why I was doing it, but was starting to see a bit of talk about it. And now that I understand the physiology of it, it makes even more sense. And I wish I would have been doing it sooner.
Right. So I'd like to talk about something else that can go along with oxytocin. And this is a study. I'm going to give you a year about when it was published, 2014. It's an Iranian study. So I would love to see this duplicated in the United States. And it's about using oral propranolol with oxytocin for induction.
Interesting.
Yes. So again, mechanisms of labor and things that work symbiotically, right, together. You know, like I always joke that like Phenergan, you know, mixed with a little potentiated morphine, right? They're like sisters. They love each other and they work really well together. This article talks about the love relationship between propranolol and oxytocin. And basically, they double-blinded their study. Half of their population got a 20 milligram oral dose of propranolol, right, along with their oxytocin. And interestingly enough, they found that oral propranolol shortens labor duration and reduces frequency of cesarean.
How interesting.
Look at my eyeballs are like popping out of my head, right? So they didn't see any significant difference in neonatal outcomes or NICU admissions, right? But for me, all you have to do is say decreased cesarean rate and decreased labor, like length of labor. And I'm like, okay, yep. That's something to pay attention to. So not everything is right for every person, but I do think that when we have tools, we should use them when appropriate.
You know, Missy, as you were saying this, one of the things that I got to thinking about is that induction of labor, when I first started as a nurse, was my goal was to have the patient admitted, the consent, signed their IV, started the PIC going before the physicians rounded the first thing in the morning, because they were going to come in and break water. And everyone had their water broken, whether they were fingertip with an amniocot or whether they were 4 centimeters. And doing that's kind of old school use of amniotomy really early before active labor, really set a time limit or started the clock. And so I think the fact that we don't break water as early as once happened also helps us have more choices in labor and what we can do if things are slower than we anticipate. So not rushing to break water. And everyone that knows me is like, but Kara, you love breaking water. I really, really, really do. But I always joke about a well-timed amniotomy. And so knowing when is the right time to do it really comes with a lot of experience and practice time, but not doing it too early. And then you've set someone up for, you know, time limitations, depending on where you practice and what the kind of standard is.
Yes. I remember those days. I remember being that nurse and I remember being yelled at by like, why is your pit not this? And then they'd come back at lunch and they'd be like, I want to know why my pit's not already at 20 or already at whatever, that whole thing. Anyway,
yeah, yes.
I feel scarred by you saying that. Okay. So I talked about propranolol, right? And I talked about Tums. I have another one.
Yep.
I want to talk about melatonin.
Ooh, I haven't heard this one. Okay.
So this article is Italian and I love it because it's brand new, just published in 2022. And the article is the role of melatonin in pregnancy and health benefits for the newborn. So just talk for a second about the benefits, right? The thing, like the mechanisms of actions of melatonin, right? So melatonin physiologically obviously helps with circadian rhythm. We know that. That's why people take it for sleep. Mm-hmm. It regulates glucose and lipid hemostasis. It actually helps to regulate all of the things that go along with reproduction. So ovulation, fertilization, and embryo implantation. But listen to this. It works synergistically with oxytocin to promote uterine contractions and provides for adequate placental perfusion.
Wow.
So fascinating, right?
Wow.
Yeah. Melatonin is also an antioxidant and an anti-inflammatory, so it can decrease oxidative stress of the muscles. It removes free radicals from oocytes and embryos. It just has all these physiologic functions, right? So in this article, and if you're really interested in it, the primary author, the last name is Verteramo, V-E-R-T-E-R-A-M-O, and it's in a journal called Biomedicines, which I've also new to like looking at some of these alternative things, right? But it goes through, it's basically a meta-analysis that talks about all these different things that melatonin does, but it breaks down, are you ready? Be prepared to be awed. Okay. All the, so it talks about melatonin in the placenta. It talks about melatonin as a benefit in high-risk pregnancy. That means in gestational diabetes, preeclampsia, growth restriction. Then it goes on to talk about melatonin in labor and how melatonin can play a role in the onset of spontaneous labor. It talks about melatonin for preterm birth and melatonin in breastfeeding. So if you were ever wondering whether there is evidence about melatonin in pregnancy, pull this article up and take it to whoever and start thinking about like which of my patients could benefit from this thing.
Yeah.
And this literally, I should give a shout out to one of my labor nurses because she's like, Missy, when you do your pit break, why don't we try some melatonin? And I'm always like, I'm willing to try anything. And again, this is me like, is there literature to support this?
Right. Right.
Crazy.
So crazy.
Okay. So I talked about Tums. I talked about propranolol as an adjunct. I talked about melatonin. And so there are so many tools, right?
Well, and I guess, you know, as you've been saying all this, I think it's so cool to think about the evidence, but I'm kind of curious. I would love to know in a generic patient situation, what does a pit break look like to you, Missy? Like what would be your plan? That you talk with the patient about, that you talk with the nurses about, what does it look like?
Okay. So what's very interesting is that in the last 6 months, it has totally changed.
Okay. Okay. So
my idea of a pit break used to be, we're going to turn the pit off for an hour. We're going to give some Toms. We're going to let the uterine muscle clear out some of its receptors and we're going to restart pit. And why? Okay. So generally, these are patients that I already have an internal IUPC in, and they're just not adequately contracting despite being on 20, 30, even 40 of Pitocin. Like why? Right?
Yeah.
So I'm trying to get their uterine muscle I'm trying to bend it into submission. Right. So I've tried all the things, right? I've put the IUPC in, I've titrated the Pitocin up, or my nurses have titrated the Pitocin up, and I'm just like, I'm going to take a break. Okay. The other thing that I don't know that there's any evidence for is I always tell them to switch the bag of Pitocin.
I knew this was going to come up because maybe I've done the same thing.
Because I do think, and we're going to have to call Teresa Ash on this one and ask her because she's our PharmD friend. The molecular weight of the Pitocin in the fluid is heavier. And as it hangs, I do think that sometimes, I don't know, maybe I'm crazy, that you've given half the bag of Pitocin and there's no Pitocin left in the bag and it's just fluid.
We gave all the good stuff early on.
So when I do a pit break, I always have them change the bag. I know that is probably super old school, but maybe it's just warding off evil spirits, but it's a thing. Yeah. And then I would turn it back on. Right. And a lot of times I would just have them turn it back on high dose protocol. Right. Because if I've already had them on 30 and I've stopped it, a lot of people would be like, oh, let's stop it for an hour and turn it on at half. Once their uterus has had a little break, half still might be too much. Right.
Right.
So I will just have them start again at 6 and then go up 6 by 6 every 30 minutes.
I like that idea. I was going to say the same thing. If, you know, what do you restart at? And I've heard people say for years, half, and that doesn't quite seem right to me. Because the whole point was that we were clearing out the receptors. And so I don't want to slam a ton of Pitocin in those receptors right away.
Right. So I go up 6x6. And then within like 3 or 4 hours, you're back up to where you were on your Pitocin anyway, right? And maybe it worked and maybe it didn't. So that's the first thing. That's what I probably would have always done up till 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now I feel kind of strongly about what happens if we just turn it off and leave it off.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have done that recently. We have seen some tachysystole in patients who get to 6 centimeters, and we have turned their PET off because, not because we were giving them a break, but because of tachysystole, and we've never had to turn it back on.
Mm-hmm.
Because their bodies are just like, okay, I'll do what you tell me to do.
Right.
And now there's literature to support, okay, I'll tell you that I know what I'm doing and I'll just do it. So I think for me now, a PET break looks different. Like, do we just leave it off for a hot minute and see what happens?
Well, it's so funny because I used to cover the labor floor while the OB residents would go do their didactics. And they always made fun of me because it was like, Kara, you love breaking water and you love a good PET break. And I'm like, yeah, like we got to decide where we're going with this. Either we're committed and we're breaking water, or we're going to take a break, catch our breath for a second and restart. So I agree with you. I think a PET break looks different when you've had someone that isn't in active labor and they've been on 20 or 30 all day and they're barely even feeling contractions. My PIP breaks definitely are at least an hour, include usually a shower and or at least brushing your teeth and getting some food. And I think that that looks different than when you've got someone that, like you mentioned, that is in active labor. They are internalized with monitors and we're committed to the thing. They're maybe even have an epidural or that sort of thing. So they're not able to get up and shower, but it still can be a period of time, give some Tums, and then think about restarting whether or not you need to restart or not.
I also want to be real clear. Like, this is very clinically dependent on the picture of the patient.
Yes, absolutely.
I also think obesity, high BMI, bodies that don't respond to ripening agents and oxytocin the same way that, like, not every body responds the way it should. I have literally started PIT on somebody and seen nothing happen and then gone back and done another dose of Cytotec. Like,
yeah,
it's very, this is a very much clinical judgment call. And I feel like how we use oxytocin and how we pause it or don't pause it, how we manage it is very much an art.
Yes.
And not a science. Because after talking about all the things that I've talked about, or we've talked about in the last 45 minutes is, gosh, there's so many options and when are they appropriate? And what does the evidence say? And is it strong enough evidence for us to actually change how we practice?
Yeah. And I think it's really, really helpful. Most of us as midwives have for years said, like, to our people around us, trust me on this. Let me try this thing. And now it's nice that you can go find some literature. You can find some evidence. You can find things that are printed in the Green Journal. Those kinds of ideas that may speak to the other providers that we work with, that we're not doing this, you know, midwife magic or voodoo, but that there is evidence to support all the things we've been doing for years.
Yes. I'm like, Missy is validated. And because the nurses tease, they're like, well, are we going to do a Missy PIT break?
Yeah.
It's not just a Missy PIT break. It's a evidence-based strategy for decreasing cesarean rate.
Exactly. I have loved this conversation and I love that we've been able to talk about the physiology behind why some of these things work. And we've been able to honor some of our midwifery tenets, while also really talking about something that sometimes is medical management.
Yeah. And I also think this, like, no matter where you practice and how, like, if you are in a hospital situation, because it's harder, like home birth and birth centers, like they don't deal with the kinds of things like this that we deal with, right?
Right.
But if you're in a hospital situation, whether you're in a community hospital that, like, you know, deals with all low risk people, or you're in a high risk, you know, tertiary care center, like I am, there is something in this conversation for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. And for our home birth and birth center colleagues, when their patients transfer in, oftentimes it's because of progress or lack of progress, and it's because they may need some augmentation with Pitocin. So it is important to understand all of the ways that this works.
I was also just thinking when we were talking about propranolol, I'm like, not everybody can have that.
Well, no, but I mean, we're if using good clinical judgment.
With my induction, I'd probably be on the floor because you'll bottom out my blood pressure.
And some of us, you know, lowering our blood pressure a little wouldn't be so bad.
I do love what you just said, though, about, like, this gives a lot of validity to some of the things that we have always done, or that we have done that didn't, like, wasn't supported. Like, yeah. So
I love this.
I know, it's fun. I hope our students listen to it and they're like, oh, like, these are some things I'm going to try. I mean, these are not the things that are going to be on your boards, but they're definitely very clinically relevant. And I love the growing body of literature on the things that are outside of what we would normally consider in the intrapartum setting. And I'd like to see more of it. I'd like to see, yes, you know, the conversations about, like, do the other empiric things that we know work. Is there a way to show that there's good evidence to support them? So another conversation. Yeah. For another day.
Yeah, sounds good. Well, thanks for all of this really interesting info and building, you know, tying together our science and the art and science of midwifery.
I love it. So thanks for joining us for this episode of the Engaged Midwife Podcast. We can't wait to talk to you again.
Take care.